Great looks coupled with great play, it all added up to being known far beyond the golf course, and looks aside, folks, earned a spot in the World Golf Hall of Fame for our special guest today on Musings on Golf. I am Kelly Elbin, welcoming you back to our weekly gathering alongside Jenna Self, our executive producer, who always makes musings flow so well. Got to tell you, we both thoroughly enjoyed the interview with Jan Stevenson that we conducted yesterday and that you'll hear in a few minutes. Jan is a true pioneer in the women's game. She took it to levels visually, certainly, that women's golf had never gone to before. At the same time, to be very blunt, she wasn't exactly beloved by many of her contemporaries who saw her as someone that maybe they didn't want to be, and maybe they didn't want their sport to be recognized for. So she covers a lot of that. It's a really far-reaching interview. I thoroughly was impressed with her. I mean, she grew up in Australia, came over here, had immediate success, was the rookie of the year, went on, you know, she won 16 times in the LPGA Tour, three major championships, one in particular. How she won it is a story unto itself. But Jan, you know, she appeared three times on the Tonight Show. She received a congratulatory call after winning the Women's Open from then President Reagan. She was more than just a golfer, for sure. We're going to hear from Jan in a bit. You'll really enjoy it. Okay, before we get to that, this is a very personal note, and a very personal note. So pleased to read and to find out that the Maryland State Golf Association has renamed its Men's Player of the Year honor to the Martin R. West III Player of the Year Award. Folks, I am a very proud Marylander. I grew up outside of the D.C. area. And to see that Marty West, easily the most accomplished male golfer, amateur golfer in the history of the state of Maryland, be recognized with this honor is something that is really, you know, for his legacy. Marty, the proof has already been in the pudding for Marty. How about this? He won 9 Maryland amateur titles, 3 Maryland Opens. In all, he won 22 Maryland State Golf Association championships. And this is a big deal because there are a lot of excellent golf clubs, private golf clubs in the D.C. area. And Columbia Country Club, where Marty has been a longtime member, is certainly at the top of that list. Marty helped Columbia Country Club to 12 state team championships. Now, Columbia Country Club is not only been known through the years for having great players, but incredibly, over the span of more than 100 years, had only 3 golf professionals. The great Freddie McLeod, who was one of the first honorary starters at the Masters Tournament. The legendary and incredible coach Bill Strasbaugh, much honored through his years with the PGA of America. And then my good buddy Bob Dolan, who recently retired. Think about the club, their course where you may play, that golf professional, if he or she is there for 5 years or 10 years, that's pretty good. To have 3 head professionals in more than 100 years, absolutely remarkable. Marty and I actually went to the same high school, as did a buddy of mine, John Myers. John and I were both in the class of 79. That makes me 65 years young, folks. And Johnny and I were commiserating about the other day as to where the time went. And that is just life. But as John pointed out, he and Marty were teammates during a stretch when Columbia Country Club captured 5 straight state titles in these team matches. And the two of them together were 35-0 in their matches. Talk about a couple of studs who paired extremely well together. But, you know, it's not surprising. Marty West, I mentioned all of that on the Maryland front. Marty West played in 19 U.S. amateurs. He was a major force on the national level. Played in 2 U.S. Opens. Played in 4 Masters. So, again, to see that Marty's been recognized by the Maryland State Golf Association with the Marty West Player of the Year Award could not go to anybody more deserving. And talk about deserving. The way it's been going for Cameron Young, all eyes should be on him for winning the PGA Championship that's going to start next week at Aronimink Golf Club outside of Philadelphia. Cameron Young's on fire. I've gotten to know his dad, David, as I've mentioned a few times, longtime PGA of America professional. David's been his only coach. He's the one who's worked on that swing with I like that little pause at the top of Cameron's swing. It's not something I would encourage anybody else to have, but that little pause at the top gets him set, and that lower body starts firing through. And you can see these distances, 350 yards, 330 yards, 340 yards off the tee. He's ridiculously long off the tee, and the iron play has gotten to the point where he is now pinpoint. I mean, you got to remember, he didn't win his first tour event until last summer in North Carolina. And then the real breakthrough against a strong field came at the Players Championship in dramatic fashion when he beat Matt Fitzpatrick by a stroke at Sawgrass. And now with this victory, another going away victory as he had in North Carolina at the Cadillac Championship, in his last six starts, Cameron Young, two wins, two third places, and a seventh place. And let's hear what Cameron Young had to say about the areas where he feels the greatest improvements have occurred for him, propel him to where he is today.
You know, I think I keep just slowly improving in, I think, all really the different areas of the game. And I think I'm slightly better just everywhere than I was a year ago. And, you know, that's the goal, just keep incrementally getting a little bit better. And, you know, when you do that, I think the good weeks come together and they look more like this as opposed to finishing, you know, second, third, fifth, where you had a chance to win and didn't. Winning is really hard. It's not, at no point did it feel easy. Did it feel like the tournament was over? You know, even the last couple holes, there's a lot that can happen and you're never quite sure what the guys in front of you are going to do, the other guys in your group. So it was really just a matter of keeping my head down and trying to play good golf all the way through.
Now, life is not too bad as well for Scottie Scheffler. Interestingly enough, Scheffler's taking the week off this week at the Truist Championship in North Carolina, where he won last year at Quail Hollow. Ironically, the golf course where he won the PGA Championship, he won't be playing this week because the PGA Championship is next week. He needs a little bit of a break. I understand it. He's got some events in Texas following the PGA. But in his last three starts for Scottie Scheffler, second, second, and second in three consecutive starts, he's won $6,750,000. Talk about how good the prize money is right now at the very elite level for the men professional golfers. Okay, on to Jan Stevenson. As I said, I was just impressed in talking with her. She's doing a lot of really good work with her Crossroads Foundation. You're going to find out about that. And before I throw it over to our sponsors, remember to subscribe to us, to listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you enjoy Musings on Golf and your other favorite podcasts. Right now, let's hear from our corporate friends, our great partners at William & Harry and the Friars Golf Club, and then on to Jan Stevenson. Our friends at William & Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William & Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. Her 16 LPGA victories, including three major championships, earned her induction to the World Golf Hall of Fame, Class of 2019. She was awarded a Medal of the Order of Australia for service to golf and to not-for-profit organizations. She was also awarded recognition by the Military Order of the Purple Heart for her service to combat wounded, disabled, and blind veterans, as well as first responders. Oh, and she once famously posed in a bathtub filled with golf balls while wearing not very much at all. What a treat to welcome Jan Stevenson to Musings on Golf. Jan, how are you?
No, I'm great. Thank you, Kelly.
Jan, it's so great to catch up with you. We have a lot to talk about in terms of your career. But, you know, in doing the research on you, you are a very active woman. You are staying busy with lots of different things, primarily off the golf course. If you would, Jan, kind of catch up our listeners to what you're doing these days and really what drives your passions.
Well, I actually, with one of my business partners that runs a golf course, we own a golf course with my foundation. And so that keeps me pretty busy because I do a clinic about once a month for the veterans, and they come in from all around the state. And it's always so inspiring. I mean, you know, we talked about it with Dennis Walters. It's just amazing what they can do and their attitude. And then I teach the blind about once every 3 months. There's a blind school that come in, and the first time they came, they said that you know, don't be upset if the kids don't want to stay, because they, you know, they get so frustrated with whatever sport they have to do.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, but I had already trained the teachers that were there that were volunteering, and I had designed shafts with noodles on them. So I had them all stand up against that and then just turn their right side and stay against the noodle. And they all started making contact with the ball, and they loved it. And then when we went over the putting green, I had little boards for them to be on putting. And the people there were a lot of people in the outside on the patio, and they were clapping when they made a putt. So when it was time for them to leave, they didn't want to leave. We know we gave them lunch, and then they said, okay, the bus is here. And they went, no, we're having such a good time. So they stayed another hour or two, and that was really fun.
And before we went on, you and I were talking about Dennis Walters, our mutual friend. Dennis was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame along with you in 2019. And Dennis, unfortunately, had a terrible golf cart accident, and he's gone on to perform tens of thousands of golf trick shot shows. My point on that is, and to your point of what you're saying there, is golf has the ability to bring in so many people in ways that you'd never think. That your story is one example. It's maybe what's unique about our game.
It is. I mean, that's the wonderful thing, is that you can, no matter what your age or what your handicap or if, you know, anything, you can still find a way to play golf, and it's just to be outside, and, you know, it's so enjoying, and just to be with other people as well. I mean, that's the thing I've noticed with the military, the camaraderie they have. If someone's having a problem, they all get behind them and make them feel better. So there's so much to it socially that it's just a wonderful sport.
Is what we're talking about all fall under your Crossroads Foundation, or is that a separate entity?
No, that's part of it, the jscrossroads.org or janscrossroads.org. But that's where you can go and learn about it. And actually, it's one of those things that I always used to really appreciate the military and do a lot for them, just playing in pro-ams. And I was doing a lot with junior golf, but then as I got where I couldn't play on the regular tour, I used to bring players, young players from Australia, and Kari Webb asked me if she could have that because she was still playing on tour, and she's gone on and taken it to another level. I mean, she brought in Minji Lee and Hannah Green to the tour, and so it's been really good. So I didn't have, you know, I was like, okay, well, the junior program's taken care of, and there's lots and lots of junior programs. I'm not taking that away. We've got some wonderful programs, but every time I was with the military, they were struggling to find a place to play and practice. And so I felt like this was something that would be really good. And it has been. I mean, when we had the Warrior Games, I think it might have been in 2019 or maybe 2018, we had the Warrior Games, which is kind of like they have the Invictus Games. So it was hosted by the Special Ops in MacDill Air Force Base here in Tampa. And the colonel and the general asked me if I would, if they could use my golf course for them to come in and train, and would I handicap and figure out which tees each of the players would have to be from around the world. And that was when I just got so hooked. It was great. And then they asked me if I would train the special ops team, who weren't very good. And it was really hard work getting them every day out there and making them practice. But we got a bronze medal. So it was, and they asked me if I would walk with them in the opening ceremony as an honorary coach. And that was really neat.
You mentioned your course. Tarpon Woods is your golf club. Did you design the golf course there?
Yeah, we bought the golf course in. It's not in very good shape. It's a public golf course and we lose a little bit of money every year, but it's just fun to be there for everybody. And we're actually going to spend the money this summer to try to get the golf course in better shape for the next season.
I mentioned about so much of what you're doing off the course. You were even a contestant in Dancing with the Stars Australia, Jan Stevenson, in 2013. How did that come to be, and how far did you and your dance partner go?
Well, it's probably one of my most embarrassing moments because Jane Seymour is a good friend of mine, and she'd been in the one over here in America, and she had such a good time. And when I went to visit her, staying with her, and she was going up to Vegas to do an exhibition of her dancing, but she was a past ballet, you know, it's a really good dancer. And she said, you know, you should do that if you get an opportunity. So I was in Australia, and I was at the time, this was about 2010 or 11. And I was thinking of moving back to Australia and going into politics. And the party at the time said, well, everybody needs to know that the hometown hero is coming back, so we'd like to put you in Dancing with the Stars. And I went, oh, okay. Jane said it was a good experience. And I said, but I don't know how to dance. And I'm still playing on the champions, on our Legends Tour, which is like the Champions Tour. I still have a commitment with my sponsors to play quite a few tournaments. I think I committed to 11 tournaments that into 11. And I was like, I don't know how I'm ever going to be able to do both. And so I went for the interview, and my mom, who used to be a dancer, and she had had a stroke. And so she loved that show. And she's like, oh, you finally could learn to dance. And I went, okay. So I committed to do it. And, and I didn't read the contract. It said you had to, you know, practice for 7 weeks in a row first. And apparently it had when I was going to get voted out. And I didn't know that. I didn't read the contract. I just signed it.
Oh, okay.
And so now I know how it works. I mean, I can tell you who's going to be in the finals because they always have, you know, one that'll be for my age group, for the older women. Then there'll be some kind of athlete that'll be there for the men. And then there'll be a young one. And especially in Australia, because every year the people that have their own TV shows on that channel get to the finals. So it's pretty, you can tell now it's pretty fixed, but I didn't know. I thought it was, you know, I mean, when they say it's a reality show, it's not really, but I worked really hard. I got terrible blisters every day. And I made the mistake of, you're supposed to do it in Australia, it's for charity. So people call in and it costs money and you vote for whoever it is and that goes to the charity. So I was friends with Olivia Newton-John at the time, and she, I made it her charity because I really believed in her cancer and her natural, you know, she did a lot of natural stuff and that was not included in insurance in Australia. So I thought I chose her charity. And I didn't do my hometown, which was a big mistake. I did my town where my coach was living. And so I didn't know anyone and we couldn't do any campaigning because you have to do a lot of campaigning to get votes. So, but I thought, okay, I'm just going to be a really good dancer and it won't matter, which, you know, silly thing to think. So, that it would be about, you know, your talent. So we worked really hard. I had terrible blisters. I thought I was going to be able to work with my coach every afternoon, but it turned out that I was so worn out because you really work hard. And my partner was an ex-ballet from Australian Ballet Corps. So he made me like get on the bar and stretch and do all kinds of warm-up stuff, which actually turned out to be great because my back has been great ever since. But it was a great, you know, now I know how to work it. I wish I'd know how to do it right. And so, but when it got time for me to be knocked out, I could tell when they were knocking, you know, coming down to the last few. And I figured I didn't campaign that week because I got Olivia Newton-John to come in from America and be a guest judge. So I'm like, oh, I'm going to keep the campaigning for next week when she's not there. They would never kick me off when I'm bringing in Olivia Newton-John, which was a mistake. And as they were coming down to the last two, I knew one of the girls was a big star and was on TV. So I'm thinking, and then I realized I was going to lose. I started crying and I couldn't stop crying because I thought of all the work I'd done, the tournament I had missed. I missed the our Honda Cup, which is like the Solheim. And I was bawling and I could not stop. And Olivia came up and was trying to hug me and the producer's going, didn't you read your contract? She's ruining the show. So the next day on all of the newspapers and the magazines for the next month was sore loser. And I was so upset that I said, I'm not going to do politics. I'm going back to America. So, but the funny thing is that actually I did like Jane, my partner came over and we did a whole bunch of exhibitions because we'd worked so hard on all these dances. And we went around the country, the country clubs and did dance exhibitions.
It was a significantly greater commitment than you ever could have imagined, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, and it was a lot harder because we would, you know, you'd have to travel down to Melbourne every week, and I thought I was going to get to work on my game, and of course I couldn't. And then it was really hard work, and it's a lot easier here in America because everything's done in the one building. They film in the, you know, they film there, yes. They stay there. And they practice there and the studio's there. So it's like one whole building but it was all over the country and it was very tiring.
Is part of your DNA, have you always been a very active, busy person? Is that just who you are, Jan?
Yeah, everybody always talks about how they've always nicknamed me the ever ready bunny because I just keep going and no matter what happens. And it's just part of my DNA. My father always had me work really hard before school and after school. Even when I was like seven, I was training for the Olympics in swimming. And every morning and every afternoon after school, we would train. And so I just, you know, learned to just work that hard.
How far did you get in terms of swimming in trying to get into the Olympic Games? Were you a serious threat to make the Australian team or did golf sort of get in the way?
Golf started getting in the way. Well, what happened was I don't like cold water. And so we're training all summer is okay to do. But then it was, I think I remember it was like June or July, which is, you know, our winter. And I jumped in the water and it was freezing cold. And I jumped back out and said, I quit. I want to do something else. And so my father started me playing tennis and then finally golf. And I loved golf.
So pleased to be joined by World Golf Hall of Fame member and Florida Sports Hall of Fame member, Jan Stevenson, here on Musings on Golf. Okay, so let's talk about your entry into golf. I believe you started playing when you were 10 in Australia. How did you get started? Did you work with someone, a PGA professional, to develop your skills? And the third part, were you good at the game pretty much right away?
Yeah, I mean, I'd already been playing tennis from after the swimming episode. I was playing tennis at 8, but my father would take me to the tennis court and then he'd go off and play this new sport called golf. And I'd always been like his shadow. And I'm like, well, wait a minute, why is he going to play golf and not playing tennis on one of the other courts? And in those days we had courts everywhere because there were so many famous Australian tennis players.
Yeah.
And so I used to sneak off. He thought I was playing tennis or when I We'd have to go to the movies on Saturday with my brother. I'd go, let's go look at golf, watch golf. And my brother wanted, we had a little country house in a surf town just north of Sydney, where we spent the weekends, and that's where my father was playing golf. And I would be like watching the golf swings, and I had a stick, and I'd be copying, and I started selling golf balls because would be in the bush hiding, and I started selling golf balls. And then my brother would catch snakes because there were so many snakes in the bush back then. And so I hid my golf stick, and he would hide his shoebox. And then he would take the snakes down to the local reptile park, and he'd get a lot of money if he could keep buy them live. And then one day somebody told my dad, you know, Jan's got a really good golf swing. You should let her play golf. And he went, what? You mean tennis? And he said, no. They're here all the time selling golf balls and catching snakes. And he went, what? And so my parents, they used to play on Saturday. That's why they would drop us at the movie theater. And then they'd go play golf in the mixed comp in the afternoon. So one time he dropped us there, and we used to wait a few minutes. We'd look at the picture of what the movie we were going to see, and we'd make up a story of what it was about. Then we'd head on and we'd walk back to the golf course. Well, my father was waiting outside the movie theater and went busted, and we went, whoops. And so he said, you know, I'm going to let you, why do you want to do it? I said, I really want to play golf. And he said, okay. But you can't change sports anymore. How are you going to be a professional if you keep changing sports? You've gone from swimming to tennis to golf. That's it. You can't have any other sports. I went, okay, I promise, golf is it. So, and I was, my dad, they cut me down some clubs, and my mom actually made me up a golf bag. And which she actually had two jobs. One, she was the, she worked as an accountant at Unilever, but she also worked doing the books for a little dress shop where we lived in Sydney. And she made a golf bag up out of canvas for me. And so I had a canvas golf bag. I was so proud of myself with golf clubs. And so with the local pro started me playing golf, and because my dad's like, we're going to have to get proper coaching. And so he started me, and I loved it. And I started winning right away.
In fact, you did, and then you turned professional in 73. That year, you won the Wills Australian Ladies Open. Dan, did you expect to win right away? Did you feel that you were that good right away as a rookie professional?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been winning everything as an amateur. I'd won all the junior championships and all the regular events, and so I was pretty confident. I joined in August, and I think I won 5 of the last 10 events. And so, and 2 of them were majors, the Australian Open and the LPGA Championship. And that's when a lot of Americans came down, because at the end of the season, like they do now, they have, you know, with the PGA and the LPGA, they have, you know, the players from Europe and Australia will come, America will come down because it's the summertime down there. And they were like, you're crazy to be here. You need to come to America. So that's when I decided to do it.
Yeah. And back in January, I had the pleasure of interviewing Annika Sörenstam and talked to her a bit about going from Sweden to the U.S. and what that was like to acclimate. For you, what was that like to go from your home country to being a rookie on the LPGA Tour? You were the rookie of the year. What was that like from just living day to day, much less competing against some really good players?
Well, that's this one thing it was really hard. I was very homesick because I'd been with my parents. They traveled with me on the Australian tour, and my dad had taken me to every event. So I was really lonely, and I didn't really have that many any friends the first year. And my parents decided to split up their trip. My father took 3 months long service leave, and my mom took her leave. And they split the trip and came separately for the first year. But by the time my dad came, I'd kind of acclimatized myself to it. But it was hard at first. It was, people think because we speak English, it's going to be the same. But it wasn't anywhere near like that. You know, it was a lot harder than I thought it would be.
Your father caddied some for you, correct?
Yeah, he did. He caddied for 2 of my majors. He was my caddy. He caddied for me at the Canadian Open, Peter Jackson, and the LPGA Championship. And he caddied for me. He started caddying for me in the summer when they came over. And it was such a great time. I couldn't wait for them to come.
Jan, this has been a lot of fun so far. Let's take a little break right now and hear from our good friends at William & Harry. And we'll be back right after that with more with you. At William & Harry Golf, comfort meets purpose. Through their care campaign, William & Harry is partnering with charities to give back, donating a portion of every qualifying sale to support your cause. Enhance your next fundraiser with William & Harry customized golf shoes, auction packages, or exclusive giveaways. Crafted from fine deerskin, calfskin, and exotic leathers, William & Harry golf shoes offer all-day comfort from the course to the clubhouse in vibrant, eye-catching colors. Learn more at williamandharry.com or email info@williamandharry.com. William & Harry, style with a mission. You were very much an aggressive golfer throughout your career. Was that something that your dad instilled in you? Was that just this how you decided to play the game?
Actually, he was always more defensive than me. We used to be arguing on the golf course. He'd be like, "Don't you think you want to lay up?" And I remember I lost a tournament in Connecticut at Stanwich Club, which is a beautiful golf course. And on the 17th hole, I was having a really good round, and the girl that was leading was like two grips back, and she'd never won a tournament, so I felt pretty comfortable. And I hit the ball pretty long back then, and it was a par five, and I could hit my five wood over the water on this par five and make a birdie. And my father's like, "Maybe you should hit three, because if you hit five wood, what happens if you miss hit it? You'll go in the water." And I'm like, "What?" and I'm like, "Well, I'm not going to miss hit it." And he said, "Well, just take a little bit extra. I mean, you're better off to be over the water and on over the green." Right. And I went, "Okay." So I hit the three wood, flew it over the green into the junk, and I made a bogey. And I was so mad at my dad, like so mad. And then I got up on the 18 and I hit it on the green and I three putt. I was still furious with him. And it turned out I lost by a shot. So he goes, I'll never argue with you again. And I said, "Well, you cost me a tournament." And, but after that, he never said a word, but I was always went for everything, which actually I look back now, if I'd have been more patient, especially in the majors, if I'd have been more patient, I would have. You know, I rarely finished second or third because I would just go for it. It'd be either do or die. And I look back now at the tournaments that I should have just hung in there and waited instead of pushing it.
That's a big part of it, isn't it, Jan, in terms of that the patience that's needed, right? And it's hard to – when in the moment, it's tough because you kind of want to be who you are. But yeah, it's true, right? If you just – and I've always – notice that in the great players, they're just able to sort of keep that steady hand throughout. And it's much easier said than done.
Yeah, Lopez was always great at it. And so was Annika. But it is right, especially in the majors. You know, especially the U.S. I always tell all the young juniors when I do give them a clinic is that in the U.S. Open, it really is an endurance test. Because especially in the older days, because you knew you were going to have 6.5 rounds because the USGA always had too many people playing in it that have never played in a major. You know, they qualify for it and they're so nervous. And sometimes they would, I always said, the USGA didn't know how to set up a course. You'd have a par three where they'd have the wrong paint for the penalty area. And it would usually cause two or three groups on that hole. And it would take forever, and you'd have to be so patient. And if you can make it through to the cut, then it kind of loosens up a little bit. But the first two rounds, you have to have so much patience. As I swore I'd never win an Open because I was too aggressive. And the Open that I did win was because my clubs had been stolen, and I had to borrow a set of golf clubs to play. And the guy that usually traveled the tour with our van, because now we have a million vans, but they had the one van. He was on his way to Boston for the next tournament because the Opens are always, you know, someplace that's not on the same track that the tour is on.
Right.
And so I borrowed these clubs, and they were little Wilson heads with I actually kept the clubs and this stiff shaft. And so when we got on the golf course, I had a professional caddy at the time. My father said, I'm getting too old, and it was too hot that year, that week. And we said, I can't get these clubs in the air. So we went, we're going to have to go to the front of every green and not go for a pin because they'll go over the green. And I went, okay, let's play that way. And it turned out I actually was leading after three rounds for how many greens hit, because I would just play to the front of the green. And so ever since then, I watch opens and go, you know what? They punish you for being aggressive in a USGA. You have to be very defensive. And so I remember being paired with Hollis Stacey at Hazeltine in the last round, and I was going for all the pins and over the green and long grass. And, you know, they always grew the grass up around the greens, and the greens were rock hard. And she would always just go to the front of the green. And, you know, there you're on the fairway. It's easy to pitch and putt and, you know, get up and down. And I realized that's how she won three opens. And I'm like, man, I should play that way. But I didn't until 83, when I had no choice. And then I learned from there, that's how you have to play in a U.S. Open.
Is that, of your three major championships, does one stand out for you as sort of the pinnacle?
Well, that one, because I had so much, you know, going against me. I had borrowed clubs and then I had, you know, the new commissioner, John Lopheimer, just came on, and he was like, you're not going to be the little golden girl anymore. I don't believe in, you know, focusing on just one or two players. And so he said, you're not going to be my favorite. And he would fine me for everything that year. So it was a challenge to win the Open. I'm sure he hated that. So that was, but my LPGA championship was probably my favorite win, because yeah, I actually could enjoy it because I had a two-shot lead going down the last hole. And actually, that is one where my father, I did lay up. It was a par five, and I hit a wedge on the green about 10 feet. But then instead of, everybody says, why did you go for that putt? Because I ran it like 3 feet by. And they went, what if you'd have missed that coming back? And I went, well, I'm not going to miss that. But it never even registered to me. I should have just lagged it down there, which I did for the Open.
Did you ever get nervous on the first tee of tournaments?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
How do you then shake that? Is it a case of once you get that the opening drive, then you're focused? How long do nerves last at the elite level in major events?
Oh, I don't think they go away when you're leading, because I led wire to wire on all of my majors.
Huh.
And I think I was nervous the whole day because people go, oh, you're in a zone and it goes fast. No, it goes in slow motion. You go, how long am I going to feel like this? I don't know if I like this feeling, but you get used to being able to play being nervous. I mean, you're nervous. I was nervous the whole time in all of the majors in the last day, but the first shot and then probably the last hole are the two worst ones. But and you get used to it. I mean, you get used to being able to. I mean, I would try to do a pre-shot routine and keep on that routine and not be focusing on what it meant. And same thing with the putt. Everybody says, oh, she was so cool, calm, and collected when you made the putts to win. But I was nervous wreck, but I really focused on my pre-shot. You know, how many times I look at the hole, how many times I waggle, how many times. So that even though I was nervous, I was really focused on that, not what it meant.
Jan Stevenson joining us here on Musings on Golf. We're having a lot of fun. Okay, Jan, we've got to talk in a good way, I think, in the famous photo shoot with you in a tub of golf balls. Now, that was in 86. You also had in 77, the cover of Sport magazine was a bit risque. Do you kind of view yourself as a pioneer of sorts when you look at a lot of the women influencers today? Is that something that you embraced? And it sounds like certainly there's something that the LPGA wanted and maybe needed at that time, Jan?
Definitely. I mean, when Ray Volpe came on, I mean, I think there's been two really great commissioners, and Ray Volpe and Mike Wan. And because they recognized the faults of the tour, and so they would focus on the good things. And with Ray, he said, you know, we've got to, I can't believe how talented everybody is. And we, and when I came on tour, it was pretty amazing how many great players they were. You know, we still had some of the founders playing, you know, we had Mickey Wright still playing and a whole bunch of, you know, Louis Suggs and Marilyn Smith and some really good founders still playing golf. And then you had, you know, then you've got the Sandra Haneys and the Carol Manns. And then you had, you know, Nancy come on and Julie Inkster and Amy Elk. I mean, we had so many great players and personalities, but that Ray was like, okay, we've got to change the image. And so he said, I started winning and he's like, this is perfect. You're the new, I want you to be the new image, because I didn't realize that. And he told me that the LPGA, after the lawsuit with Jane Blaylock, was really hurting financially. Because I was like, oh, but I really want to play golf. And he said, they may not be a tour if you don't do this. And so he kind of put the pressure on me then. So I did all of the Fairway magazines for him, and he set me up to be you know, like on the Johnny Carson three times, and then all of the morning shows. When I'd fly, he'd fly me in on Sunday to New York, and I would do all the morning shows every time I had a good event. And so he was the one that really put me on the map and helped the LPGA. And a lot of the players were dead against it. They said, stop selling. You know, we'd have our meetings. He'd say, what difference does it make what we sell with if they come to the tournament, if they're coming to the tournament to watch what Jan's got on? Who cares? Because once the tournament starts, they're going to stay. They're going to realize how fantastic you guys are. Because there was a lot of complaints about, we're setting women back by doing this. And he's like, but look at all the new tournaments I've got, all the prize money. I mean, he tripled the prize money and all the tournaments. And we were on TV all the time. So he was the one that started it. But then with the calendar, I had signed a big contract with Dunlop and Maxfly. And what happened is the president, Dave Brannon, had come to me and said, we've got a problem. We just bought this beautiful golf ball factory in Japan, but it's full of these golf balls that we can't get rid of, and we don't want this ball. We're starting with a really good Maxfly ball. So he said, we've got about 50,000 dozen left. Would you be prepared to do a calendar? And then we'll sell a dozen balls in your calendar. And I went, okay, sure. So they got with Dick Zimmerman, who'd already done the posters and stuff. And they developed a whole, you know, calendar of things with like a Maxfly umbrella, and then a golf bag, and then ball. And then, of course, the balls was the big one, because they're trying to sell this golf ball. So I was in this tub of balls. As it turned out, the calendar sold so fast that they had to make 300,000 dozen more golf balls because the calendar went so crazy. So that's how it all started.
That is a fabulous story. I know you knew Mr. Volpe well, and I agree with you on Mike Wan as well. What does an LPGA commissioner, when he or she is doing a good job, they're seeing what the tour needs to be. They're doing the things that take the tour to different levels. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, I think Jim Ritz, who I think he had that idea, but he left very quickly, so he didn't really have a chance. But the good thing, I mean, Mike recognized that there were a lot of Asians coming in, and so he was smart enough to go to Asia and get sponsored that way. And so instead of sticking with America, he said, okay, then we'll just take everybody to Asia and you know, and started that Asian tour. And then, of course, it's taken off from there.
I Googled recently, you mentioned about the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. I Googled an interview with him. You were on with him three times?
Well, I was on the show, yeah. I was on with Kenny Rogers was the host one time, and then a comedian was on one time. But I was on with Johnny the one time.
What do you remember from that time with Johnny?
He was so funny, because him and Ed McMahon, they were very friendly, you know, when we first get started, and they come in and interview you before, you know, while you're having your hair, makeup and stuff, and say, okay, they're going to talk about, you know, this. And so I'm like, okay. And then it was so funny, because they're like, well, what would you like to drink? And I'm like, well, I'll drink whatever you're drinking, because it looked like it was water, but it turned out to be vodka. And I didn't know. And so they went, okay. Yeah. So when I'm sitting down at the table during the interview at the commercial break, I went to have a sip and it was like, oh, this isn't water. And they went, no, it's straight vodka. And I went, okay, I can't drink that. And he was really funny because he was teasing me about, I think one of the times I was on, it was, I had just broken and earned $1 million. One of the guests on the show was talking about he had just gotten a divorce and it was costing him a fortune. He's the little guy, God, that was really good at piano. What was his name? Anyway, Johnny's like, here, you can just go hook up with Jan. She just made $1 million. He was really funny. I mean, he was like, I said, I really like your golf swing. He said, you know, it was always supposed to be a tennis swing. You know how he used to start with that swing?
Oh, yeah.
But he said, everybody thinks it's a golf swing, so I let it go.
And to be on that show, Jan, that back in those days, that was massive to be on The Tonight Show.
Oh, huge, because it had he had a big following, and there was never been any pro golfers or golfers on the show. So it was a big deal to break through.
We're winding down our time here with Jan Stevenson on Musings on Golf. You even got a congratulatory call from then President Ronald Reagan.
Oh, when I won the U.S. Open, yeah, I was on the 18th hole, and when you finally win, my father was really adamant that I needed to smell the roses when I won, because I was always like worried about the next tournament and whatever. And so I was really enjoying signing autographs and finally won a U.S. Open. And after I said I'd never be able to win one. And then one of the security guards came and said, hey, the president would like to talk to you. And I went, I can talk to the president of the club in a little while. This is really important. This is really fun. And he goes, no, the president of the United States. And I went, oh. So I went in and he was great. He was very friendly. He said, you know, I was watching you the last few holes. I got worried when you hit it in the trees on 17. So he actually was watching, and he said, I started being nervous you weren't going to do it, but I'm so proud of you. And I was like, thank you, Mr. President. It was pretty awesome.
You know, I read something recently. My friend Jaime Diaz from Golf Channel said something about you, which I think is a great summary. He said, referring to you, she was never, even in her prime, given credit for how good a player she was. She was looked at as the glamour girl who was taking a shortcut to fame, when in fact, she was a grinder who dug it out of the dirt as much as anybody. You agree with that?
Wow. That's what Lopez and everybody always say, is that she was always the last to use to go, you know, leave the range. I mean, I practiced really hard and I was always tired. I always said I would win way more tournaments if I wasn't so tired, because on a Sunday, I was always flying to New York to meet potential sponsors with Ray, and he would wine and dine them and, you know, do whatever it would take, and for 10-year contracts. I mean, we signed a lot of 10-year contracts with sponsors, 5 and 10-year contracts, and then I'd have to come back on a Tuesday without having a practice round, and I was always so tired. And then after I started doing really well, then I'd got all these offers for corporate outings that made a lot of money back then, because it really wasn't that much money. And so I was always doing something on Monday and Tuesday before the event. I just was really tired.
I had no idea that you were involved to that extent in terms of meeting with clients to get new sponsors. That was a tremendous responsibility that you took on.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I would complain to Ray, and then once Nancy came on in 76, he could use her a little bit. She was smart enough to say no. She would just say, yeah, I'll do the media stuff when I get to the golf courses, but I'm not going to fly and help you promote. That's Jan's job. So everybody, I guess Amy Alcott recently wrote a book, and she called me and said, you know, I talked to Ray Volpe and I had no idea that there were tournaments that you were doing all the press and meeting with these sponsors, she said, I didn't know. We always complained because when you got to the tournament, they wanted you in the press day, but they all knew you because you'd already done the media. And I said, yeah. She said, I'm so sorry that we were all complaining that it was always Jan, but
wow,
because of all the work he did.
How'd that make you feel to hear from Amy saying that? Was there the sense of appreciation for them?
Yeah, it was. I mean, and since then, there's been quite a few players that have realized that because of what Amy said.
What's it like to get the call to say that you've been elected into the World Golf Hall of Fame?
Well, it was pretty incredible because I was always on the final ballot because I'd won so many majors. And then they started recognizing all the international wins because, you know, I'd won in Europe and in Japan and in Australia. And up until recently, they didn't recognize those because I wasn't part of the European tour or the Australian tour. So I was kind of, when I'd go over there, I'd be just there as a guest, you know, and I would win. So when every year I'd be in the final vote, which is usually down to the last few, I think there's like, in those days, it was like three subcommittees. But when it got to be no more media doing it, it's just players and past or Hall of Famers. And so the last two of them before then, there was four. It was Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, Nancy Lopez, and Gary Player. And then when Arnie died, then Annika took his place. And they were the final four that would then choose the last ones and then be having to, and then they'd call. And so every year I'd get to the finals and Nancy would be chosen to call me and say, you didn't make it. And so she would, whenever she called, I'd see her name and it was time, you know, they're going to announce it. And I'd see her name and go, okay, this is going to be it. And she'd be crying when she got on the phone and I'd be going, oh, and she'd go, I'm so sorry. I know you're going to get in because your credentials are so incredible. And I know what you did for the tour and they're not even thinking about that. They don't even discuss that because it's always just about your wins. And I went, that's okay, Nancy. So when she called me in 2019, in January of 2019, she was crying again. And I said, it's okay. Don't worry about it. I'm used to it. I said, I guess my book will have to come out and then maybe they'll see all the work that I did for the tour. And she said, no, you may. And I was crying by then. So she's like, no. And then she was trying to stop me from crying. And then I heard Gary Player and Jack laugh. And I went, what? They're laughing while I'm crying and I didn't make it. And they went, tell her, Nancy, tell her, because they're all on speaker. They didn't want to be there when they had to tell me I didn't make it. And right. He goes, no, you made it. Stop crying. You made it. And I said, well, you were crying, so I thought I didn't make it again. So she said, no, you're in. So that was a big deal.
Wow, to have Nancy Lopez, Jack Nicklaus, and Gary Player on the line.
Yeah.
Pretty good stuff, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Final question, Jan, and one that that I ask at the end of all of our Musings on Golf interviews. If you could have a three individuals, whether they're still with us or they're deceased, play a magical round of golf to round out a green foursome for you, who would those three be and where would you go tee it up?
Oh, wow. Well, obviously my dad. I'd love to play with my dad again. He was so instrumental in my whole career. I wish I'd have listened to him more. But you never want to listen to your parents, right?
It's true.
And Ben Hogan is someone's very special to me. He was really good to me. Ben Hogan and I'd like to play with the president again. I played with him a lot in the 70s, and I'd like to play with him again.
What about Mr. Hogan? How well did you get to know him?
Well, in the summertime, I had a place at Fort Worth. And so I was a member at Shady Oaks where he practiced every day. And it was actually a funny story, but in the old days, when they played the Colonial, it was the last PGA event that was not sponsored by a corporate sponsor. It was sponsored by locals. Like, you know, all the locals had put the money in. And so it was a big deal. The owner of Shady Oaks and Colonial, Marty, Marvin Leonard's daughter, She had, we, they used to, every year they would get one of the Texan PGA guys to come and do the luncheons and, you know, where they do $1,000 plate at all of the local sport that luncheons. And then the final one was a $5,000 plate at Colonial dinner. And they would give the PGA pro, for helping raise all the money for the tournament, they'd give them an honorary membership at Colonial. But they'd used all the PGA guys up. And Marty said to Ben Hogan, when he asked who they were going to have, she said, "I'm thinking of asking Jan." And he went, "Why would an LPGA player want to help the PGA? And she said, "Well, you know, she's a member here, and we'll just give her one at Colonial. She might want to do it." So, and he said, "Well, if she does it, I'll be the one that gives her honorary membership. I'll come to the dinner," oh, which is huge to have Ben Hogan go to the dinner. And she went, "Oh, wow." So when Marty came to me, she said, "This would be huge because we can sell for 5,000, you know, the place easily if Ben Hogan's going to be there and speak." And she said, "Will you do it?" And I went, "Okay." So again, I had a lot to do, and I would come in, when I'd come home, I'd go to the luncheons and I'd do all that. So when it got time for the big dinner, and Ben was like, "That was so nice of you to do that." And I said, "Are you really going to give me the membership?" He said, "Absolutely. I can't wait." And so when it got time for the dinner, you know, in those days, I had an image to uphold. I mean, I worked out all the time to keep it, but I had bought this really pretty mini from Rodeo Drive. So it cost me a fortune, but it was a little tiny leather white mini skirt and a little white leather jacket. And you just wore a little camisole under it. And it was very short. And I showed up at the dinner. And of course, Ben raised his eyebrows because, you know, he was very proper. And I was sitting to the right of him. So he gets up to give the award. And it was so hot in there with all the people that I took my jacket off while he was speaking. And he looked at me and then looked again. And this is typical of Ben, right? Because he's so dry. He goes, "Now, you know, everybody knows what a big deal it is for me to be here and to go out. I'm not a big social person, but I just thought it was so wonderful that Jan would give her time for a PGA event." So everybody was clapping. But he said, "What I didn't realize is that she doesn't think it's that big a deal because she's wearing her underwear."
Oh. And
brought the house down. It was so funny.
I would never have expected that kind of humor from Mr. Hogan.
I know. And it just was so funny that it came out with that. Because I didn't have a bra on. I just had this camisole top. And it was like so funny.
Jan Stevenson, this has been terrific. At the start, we mentioned your Crossroads Foundation. So let's wrap up with that. Please tell our listeners where they can learn more, contribute in whatever way they may see to the great things you're doing.
Okay, thank you. It's jscrossroads.org or janscrossroads.org.
Jan, that was absolutely terrific. We thank you so much for joining us here on Musings on Golf. And next week, we've got two shows for you, folks. On Monday, Jeff Kitty, the PGA head professional at Aronimink Golf Club outside of Philadelphia, where the PGA Championship will be played next week. And then on Wednesday, PGA of America professional Sarah Bush, who will catch us up on all the wonderful things that are taking place at Folds of Honor. Also, not looking too far down the road, Fred Funk and Bobby Clampett will be among our guests here on Musings on Golf. For the wizard behind the dials, Jenna Self, our executive producer, Kelly Elbin, signing off and thanking you once again for listening to us at Musings on Golf.